This is GeoTalks, a podcast by Blue Marble Geographics. Dr. Will Gutitsky is a professor at the University of New England. He's researching the impacts of climate change on coastal communities here in Maine, as well as on glaciers around the world. Dr. Gutitsky's research on the Camp Ellis Jetty combines collaboration with his community in Saco Bay and his experience studying sea level rise with GIS technology. So welcome to the GeoTalks podcast. I'm Meg Scribner.
And I'm Mariah Hyduk.
Thanks for joining me on the podcast today, Mariah.
I'm happy to be back, Meg.
I'm glad.
So today, I'm excited to introduce our guest, Dr. Will Gutitsky, who's joining us from the University of New England. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gutitsky. How are you today?
Great. It's great to be with you all. Thanks for having me.
We're excited to discuss your work studying the effects of climate change on coastal communities. Would you tell our listeners how glaciers and sea level rise relate to that research?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we think globally, what's happening, climate change is impacting virtually every aspect of our lives, right? So as humans are burning fossil fuels, that combustion is causing CO2 emissions, which is warming our planet, as we know. And that change is happening across the planet without exception. The place that's warming the fastest is the Arctic. This is a fairly well understood mechanism that's called the sea ice albedo feedback. So as the atmosphere has warmed, sea ice has melted. Sea ice is super bright. It has a super high albedo. As we get less sea ice, that turns to dark ocean, which absorbs more heat from solar radiation, causing the Arctic to warm faster than any other place on the planet. With that warming, of course, ice starts melting, right? So glaciers already exist right where they, right at the equilibrium, where there's enough snow that lasts from year to year to allow them to persist. And so as the climate has warmed, even just the few degrees that we've seen has caused dramatic decline in glaciers across the Arctic, across to a lesser extent, the Antarctic as well, which will change in the coming decades. But right, the focus really has been in the Arctic. That change, as we lose mass of glaciers in the Arctic, is causing sea level rise across the planet. And so that's really what we've been seeing over the last several decades, is that sea level rise has accelerated. Coastal communities are really impacted, particularly during storm events. And so storm events are really the pain point, because you have all this sea level rise that's occurring, but storm surge is often maybe even an order of magnitude greater than sea level rise. And so our communities, our coastal communities have been built, we've adapted to these storms, right? But we don't want to pay unnecessarily. So people have adapted to be just enough, right, to the big storms. And now we're seeing higher storm surges, stronger storms on top of sea level rise leads to a lot of this high cost in living in coastal environments. We've seen that here where I am in Maine. I'm sure we'll get into this, but we've had some really bad storms in January 10th and 13th that really damaged a lot of our coast this year, 2024. But we see this across the country and across the world. And so you think often Florida as being a place where there's a lot of infrastructure right at sea level, already heavily impacted, particularly during hurricane season. Our projections, you know, the projections of the scientific community coming going forward over the next decades are, it's going to be a rough time to live in Florida, right, as one example. But that's going to be true for coastal communities around the country. And so my group has really been focused on what we're doing here at the University of New England, has really been focused on trying to connect what we're seeing in the Arctic, all the changes that we're seeing, the really rapid melting and disappearance of glaciers, to the changes that we're seeing here on the coast, particularly here in southern Maine, where I'm located, that we're seeing these really large impacts on our coastal communities. That's making it hard to live on the coast, making it expensive, making it costly for taxpayers and residents alike. So lots of challenges. I'm very happy to explore that with you all today.
That sounds intense.
Thank you for giving us that kind of national scope, the idea of Florida and how it's being affected there versus us in Maine. So I'm curious, what shifted your focus to studying these impacts in Maine specifically from the glacier work you were doing?
Yeah, so when I was in undergraduate, I was an undergraduate student at Dickinson College, I got really interested in glaciers. And that kind of passion and interest was really driven by this desire to kind of quantify climate change and understand how climate is changing. So I got interested in trying to see if I could measure the changes of glaciers. I started working in Peru and just really enjoyed it. Got into remote sensing, you know, enjoyed using all types of software to quantify that change, right? When I moved to the University of Maine, I started working more in the Arctic, did my PhD at the University of Ottawa, developed some really great collaborations with Canadian colleagues, worked more in the Arctic, got to go to lots of places in the Arctic, which was just a phenomenal experience. And as I was kind of trying to make that transition from being a graduate student to faculty, I found a home here at the University of New England, which has just been a phenomenal fit. This is just a great place to work. And I kind of quickly realized that the work I was doing, you know, we always kind of were trying to sell our work to funding agencies by saying, sea level rise is why you want to pay us to go to these places in the Arctic that no one has ever been to, or very few people have ever been to understand how this landscape is going to evolve in the future, and then impact sea level rise and coastal communities. And when I came here, I thought, well, my neighbor down the road, you know, we're on Hills Beach Road here, where our campus is situated right at the confluence of the Saco River and the Atlantic Ocean. Really invite you all to come down to visit sometimes. We just have the best campus. Our neighbors down Hills Beach Road are flooded during these really big storm events. And so the kind of the thought was, how can we connect my past work in the Arctic with our neighbors here, living on the beach, living on the marsh, that are feeling the impact of melting glaciers, as well as really engage our students here at the University of New England in this really experiential education and active research to help the community, but also advance our understanding of coastal adaptation. And so really our goal is to help these communities prepare for the future, right? Help make sure they know how high they need to build, how much they need to raise their houses, what they can expect in terms of damage going forward if they continue to live where they live. How can we develop nature-based solutions that are going to build a more resilient coast? And so that's really kind of what we've engaged in this kind of uniquely challenging region as well here in Southern Maine.
Yeah, it's exciting to hear that you're collaborating with the community and your students on this work, because that's valuable. You mentioned that your efforts in planning and preparing with the local population are experientially valuable to your students. And that's awesome, because they're the ones who are going to apply these practices to their work in similar climate change scenarios in the future.
Yeah, that was really interesting to hear, like, the differences between the Arctic work you did and then how maybe now things are a little more personal. They're a little more applicable to your life because it's where you live and work, and also neighbors and friends and students. So it definitely changes our perspectives, I think, being like in the thick of it.
I agree. And just the importance of being engaged with community, right? And and responding to what the community needs. And I think often science kind of can get put in this bubble of like theoretical work or work that's not really relevant now, here and now. And so that's what I really wanted to do with our students here at the University of New England, was engage them in work that's immediately relevant, pressing, they can get their hands on and learn not only to help the current community, but prepare them for their career. And so that's what has inspired me, and what I've enjoyed most is this kind of direct community collaboration that I think benefits everyone.
That's really cool.
Getting a little more like technical, what has been your role in the research that you've conducted based on like the coastal resiliency project that you've been working on?
I've been lucky to work with some amazing students and collaborate with some great funding agencies to kind of enable this work. And so what the way we've gone about doing this as a GIS program here at the University of New England, we've really focused on building out kind of our monitoring systems. And so primarily that's drones. So we've been using a suite of drone platforms to go out and fly these beaches and collect primarily photogrammetry data, but we're starting to get into some LiDAR data. Primarily photogrammetry data to try to capture these beaches and marshes and what they look like and put them into our time capsule, right? So we can go out and fly these drones. And actually, I originally applied for funding for this work about a year ago now in fall 2023. And before we knew these big storms were going to happen. So for those who don't live in Maine, the last big storm here was in 1978. The blizzard of 78 is kind of legendary here. Amongst Mainers for being this kind of really devastating storm. And this past winter was the first time that storm in terms of water level had been topped. So just, it shows you how powerful that storm was in 1978 and kind of how unprepared we are for what's going to continue to come in seeing these kind of unprecedented events. And so I knew there would be winter storms, right? We know living in Maine, living in coastal Maine, winter is the time where we get the roughest weather on the coast. And so we were proactively monitoring with our photogrammetry drones and in a sense got lucky that we were flying just a couple weeks before this really big storm came and kind of reorganized the coastline. And so that's primarily been our focus is, you know, to get really technical for a moment for your listeners that are know these details. We have DJI Mavic 3E Enterprise and the multispectral drones that we've been flying, and then processing that through primarily using Agisoft and Global Mapper to try to calculate these changes on the beaches. So we're primarily interested in how much of the dune are we losing? So in Maine, you can no longer build new seawalls. The Department of Environmental Protection passed a regulation several decades ago that said you can't build new seawalls. You also can't raise current seawalls or alter them. So you can repair them, but you can't substantially change them. And so dunes really are the only and primary mechanism for defense in a lot of these places. And property owners can't really do anything except try to repair the dunes to the best of their ability. Of course, you can raise your house. These are adaptation measures that are important. But we wanted to go in and use our drones to kind of quantify the impacts on the beach across these variety of adaptation strategies. So in these coastal environments, we see people that have seawalls. Of course, they want to maintain them. A lot of people think seawalls are the best way to defend their property, and that's probably true in the short term. Dunes, of course, are provide a number of ecosystem services, particularly around for endangered species like the piping plover, that they can nest in these types of environments. So dunes, of course, are important not only for protecting our human-built infrastructure, but also providing ecosystem habitat. And then other people are using riprap, so these really large rocks that they'll dump on the coast, kind of a cheaper seawall to try to protect their property, right? And so we've been able to kind of see how those systems responded to these storms, and that's ongoing work that we're continuing this fall. So yeah, it's really been this kind of suite of techniques, primarily relying on drones, also using a little bit of GPS work, GNSS work to monitor these coastal environments and try to see if we can quantify how they're changing. Just for some context, one of the beaches here, it's one beach. The locals call it by three names, depending on the piece you're in: Fortunes Rocks Beach, Middle Beach, or Biddeford Pool Beach. That stretch of beach, it's a couple miles long. It lost about 100,000 tons of sand from this last storm that we had in January. So that volume of sand, we can't get back. You know, it's totally cost prohibitive to bring in dump trucks of sand from that we've mined from somewhere else to dump there, right? That's never going to happen. What we don't know is how much of that has come back this summer. We expect that we'll have gotten some of that back, but we don't know what that looks like yet. And that 100,000 tons has just come from that coastal zone that we can actually measure above the low tide line. We don't know what happened below low tide, and that's something we're kind of actively looking to expand and address. But yeah, we're trying to throw kind of every geophysical tool we can at trying to understand what's happening on the coast. You and or your listeners have other ideas for things we should be trying, would love to kind of engage on that and learn how we can better monitor the changes we're seeing here.
Yeah, well, there's a section actually at the end of the podcast where you'll be able to share where our listeners can connect with you. So if anybody's interested in that, they can check out the end of the podcast and learn more. Going back to what you were saying, I'm curious how you're using the data that you collect with the GIS technology to quantify the elements of climate change that you're seeing on the coast.
So it's a great question. And in some ways, this is why I started working on this, because what I had done in my formal education and my training working on glaciers, right? Our whole objective is how much ice was there, how much ice is there now, and then can we tell how much was lost between these two time periods, right? And so glaciers change so quickly and dramatically that we can use relatively coarse methods that are accurate to within, you know, 10 meters, 30 feet or so, and we still get estimates that are really valuable and significant. In these coastal systems, we need to be more accurate than that, right? We need to be kind of at the inch to centimeter level to really have a good measure on these things. And so that has required a slight shift in my tools, but we're really largely using the same approach. I've taken the exact same approach to calculating glacier mass balance and beach mass balance. So in glaciers, we use satellites. There's been one satellite in particular called Aster that has been incredibly useful. It's nearing the end of its life here as we speak, but it was launched in about 2000, maybe 2001. I can't remember the exact date, but it's been a total workhorse producing DEMs from photogrammetry. So it works basically by taking two pictures from different perspectives. We throw that into software, stitch it together, and we get these really great DEMs from Aster. Even though the vertical uncertainty is in the neighborhood of 10 meters, 30 feet, something like that, it works great for glaciers. That's not going to work for a lot of environments. So that's why kind of we've turned to drones to monitor these coastal landscapes. So photogrammetry is great, but of course it won't penetrate vegetation. So vegetation is a major challenge working with photogrammetry. But once we have those images, we can produce an elevation model off of it, particularly for sand, open beach. That works really well. The matching on sand and hard surfaces it's easy and very accurate. One of the major differences between what we're doing and what a surveyor might do, in a sense, particularly for volume change work, it doesn't really matter how accurate we are absolutely. It's only the relative accuracy matters. And so we've been basically co-registering our DEMs together. So we can look at a stable surface like a parking lot, for example. If we make the assumption that a parking lot doesn't move before and after the storm, which can be a questionable assumption depending on the storm and the circumstances, but is largely pretty good, then we can use that surface to kind of fix our elevations and make sure that elevation change is zero. And then we can measure the elevation change that we actually want to see on the beach or the other adjacent environments. And so that's really how we've been able to kind of quantify the landscape change that we're seeing using this kind of co-registration method between two elevation models. What we're starting to get into now, over the summer, we acquired a LiDAR system to mount on a drone. So we have an Inspired Flight 1200A with a YellowScan Mapper LiDAR unit. And that's going to really help us penetrate this kind of thin vegetation that we see on the coast. So in marshes, we see these kind of thin, short grasses. On the beaches, we see dune grass, right? And so we also have trouble with photogrammetry with the ocean, that you can kind of get erroneous data, particularly over water. So the LiDAR will provide us a cleaner data set. It'll be a little easier to work with, although it's a little harder to collect, a little more time consuming to collect. On the back end, the processing should be a little easier. And so that's where kind of we use a suite of softwares. So a priority of mine in our GIS program here at the University of New England is to train students broadly on software. I get them to really branch out into learning a wide variety of platforms. So Global Mapper, of course, is a focus of ours, particularly with the power of being able to take these LiDAR data sets, elevation data sets, and work them through workflows and really kind of specialized tools that will allow us to extract kind of this valuable information around change and volume. So yeah, GIS is kind of a critical component of what we're doing. And, you know, we look to everything we can to try to progress our work.
Can you share some of the adverse effects that you're trying to identify in these coastal ecosystems, specifically with the multispectral imaging?
Yeah, so we just this summer, we were able to acquire the multispectral, the DJI Mavic 3N drone. And so we're really trying to use that to monitor changes in the marsh and vegetation. So one of the consequences of sea level rise is that marshes are drowning, in effect. So since we had water on this planet, marshes have been adapting to changes in sea level. The problem is that sea level is changing so rapidly that marshes can't keep up with that change, right? So they need to accrete sediment and vegetation at the same rate or faster than sea level to survive. If sea level is rising faster than a marsh can accrete new material, it will drown. And so what we're seeing here in Maine is basically the drowning of salt marshes. And so that shows itself in dying of vegetation and the expansion of what we call megapools. So these megapools are basically standing water that forms on the marshes because sea level is rising, the vegetation is inundated too much, it can't survive. These areas are formed particularly where we see agricultural impacts. So when colonists first came to this country, I mean, even before that, we know indigenous people very likely use salt marshes in many ways. We don't necessarily have that documentation, or we don't know how the extent to which they used salt marshes. We know that they were extremely prevalent across coastal, what we now call Maine. So indigenous people have had a long history here. We don't understand the extent of that history, primarily because it was not recorded. And we have collaborators here who are working on the archaeology something we're actively trying to understand more. But we have kind of written history and some documentation starting with colonists, who of course displaced the indigenous people here. But from their perspective, the easiest place to work was the salt marsh, right? It was already an area that didn't have trees. It had a lot of sun. It was flat. It was open. It was near where they were already living on the coast because they could, that's where they could most easily make their livelihood. And so they started ditching the salt marshes, trying to control the flow of water. So they would build build these ditches to try to keep areas fresher and keep the salt water out. That has had an impact to today on what we see in these salt marshes. And so you see subsidence where these old ditches were, this kind of coinciding of impacts of the historical impacts of agriculture and modern day sea level rise are kind of converging to cause this rapid expansion of pools on marshes. And so what my group here has done is shown that these pools are expanding on every single large salt marsh in Maine without exception, some of as dramatically as 50% or more since 2009. So just in the last about 15 years, we've seen this dramatic change. And so our group is actively working with partners here to restore salt marshes. So helping them raise their elevation, replanting vegetation, trying to reduce these pools. And so that's where this multispectral is super helpful, right? Where we can take, we can look at what the multispectral is telling us in the infrared bands about vegetation health and look tracking that through time. So starting to see perhaps what areas are dying, what areas that are fresh are being inundated with salt water and that vegetation type's changing, but also where are we successful in recovering vegetation that we can promote revegetation conversion from pools, which is not a very good habitat for a salt marsh sparrow, for example, that needs dry ground to nest in, kind of grasses that might be a little higher that salt marsh sparrows, which are an endangered species, could nest in. So that's where, that was one of the ways in which we're using multispectral. But you could also see it being really useful in working in coastal environments where we have dunes. So what we saw after the January storms this year, people kind of didn't know what to do, right? And the dunes are their only line of protection. We saw kind of widespread across the beaches here, more than 50% of the dunes were lost on average across the beaches. Some kept them a little better, some lost a little more, but it was about 50% of the dunes were lost. People have then tried to replant. And so basically they tried to scrape the beach. So they would take sand kind of in the intertidal zone and scrape it up into their dune and then plant dune grass in that. And so one of our questions too is, right, how well does this replanted dune grass grow? Is it able to survive, you know, multiple years? Is it able to help really hold these dunes intact? And so, yeah, this multispectral can be really helpful for looking at vegetation in a variety of ways in these coastal environments.
Thank you for telling us about that. What does the future hold for your work with the Camp Alice Jetty in Saco Bay?
Yeah, so we're seeing coastal impacts everywhere. So I could keep busy. We could have a whole center here solely dedicated to coastal studies, and we keep everyone fully employed, engaged. And there's just so much to do with the consequences of sea level rise and climate change and changing fisheries, right? There are a lot of challenges. Camp Alice is a unique challenge in certainly in Maine, probably in the country. Camp Ellis is directly across from our campus here at the University of New England, across the Saco River. And if you want to drive there by car, it's about 20 minutes. But if you want to swim there, it would take you about 30 seconds. And so Camp Ellis is unique because in the 1800s, well, I'll start before the 1800s. I'm in Biddeford, Maine. Saco, Maine is across the river from us. This area had some of the biggest textile mills in the world in the early 1800s. This area, because of the Saco River, was just a very productive area. So they needed to export textiles and they needed to import coal so that they could run these factories. As they were, you know, this economy was growing, this industry was growing here, they wanted to bring bigger ships in, right, to move these products. And the Saco River, for those that have been in this region, you know, it drains from Mount Washington, which is the highest peak in our region, out here to into the Gulf of Maine. And so the White Mountains in New Hampshire around Mount Washington are eroding down here to coastal Maine. And so the Saco River is bringing massive amounts of sand down here. That caused a lot of challenges for these mariners who were trying to navigate the river and bring out textiles and bring in coal. And so the federal government in the 1800s decided they were going to build a jetty. And so a jetty is effectively a pile of rocks that extends out into the ocean that will, in this case, it was designed to send sand further out. So instead of having that sand build up and form a delta as it naturally would, it kind of gets shot out into deeper parts of the ocean where it won't cause a problem for commerce. And they have since been dredging that channel to keep it even deeper for navigation. The problem with that, of course, is that this coastal environment had formed around this source of sand. And so this delta had formed and people had built homes on the coast that were relying on this source of sand for their structural stability to be where they were. And so over kind of decades, as that system has been starved of sand, that has now caused lots of erosion. So what people did not realize as well in the 1800s was that in Maine, generally, currents flow from north to south along the coast. Saco Bay is an exception where they kind of turn back up. So they actually flow from south to north. And that causes kind of erosion right at Camp Ellis. And so water comes into Camp Ellis, hits the jetty, kind of gets turned around and starts moving up the coast. So for those of you, if you Google Saco Bay, Saco, Maine, you can kind of see this little bay. Sand is getting moved from the southern end of Saco Bay and Saco, Maine, up to Pine Point and Scarborough at the northern end of Saco Bay. And so you can see this actually a lot of accretion happening, and the sand is growing there into the river channel on the north end of the bay here. That history of erosion then has caused the loss of over 30 homes right on the coast in Camp Ellis. That coast has been heavily armored now, so there's mostly riprap, some seawalls along most of that coast. There's very little dune left because people are just desperate for anything to try to hold on to their homes. You see people there that have raised or are currently raising their houses up onto stilts so that the floodwaters will just go under them. So they are uniquely challenged. The Army Corps built the jetty in the 1800s. They did not recognize for a long time that that caused any problem. They finally have recognized, and just in the last couple of decades, that that did in fact cause a problem. And so now they are committed to providing some solution to help ameliorate the problem. I think everyone broadly recognizes that nothing is sufficient for kind of the damage that we're seeing. But the U.S. federal government has recently approved just over $40 million for the construction of a new piece of the jetty perpendicular to the current jetty that I think the residents largely view as it will help, but it's not going to solve problems, right? And so I think residents of Camp Ellis acknowledge that something's better than nothing. So, you know, they're happy to have this support from the federal government, but we all know the long-term challenges of sea level rise. This isn't a place that's going to be easy to live in the coming decades. But people are going to try. There's a lot of cultural heritage there. There's a lot of history. It's a gorgeous spot and you can't blame them. At the same time, it's going to be very expensive for everyone. And so we're going to see the construction of this jetty, this additional spur jetty, planned to be about 750 feet. That's going to come straight north off of the jetty, the Saco River jetty. And so, yeah, my group is really interested to see how this is going to change ocean circulation and coastal erosion patterns in this region moving forward. And so one of the questions is, well, just a basic question, is this jetty effective, right? So will it do what they say it's going to do, which is reduce the wave energy coming in, and therefore we hope reduce erosion on the coast? They're going to follow up the installation of this additional spur jetty with dredging and beach replenishment. So they're going to be taking sand from other nearby coastal environments and moving it to the beach in an effort to try to build back the beach that was there. You know, we know these efforts will be futile because the ocean currents are still going to move from south to north. That jetty that's there is still blocking sediment moving from the Saco River north there up the coast of Saco Bay. So these kind of fundamental dynamics are not going to change. And kind of the question is, how often can this community afford, how often will the state, the federal government agree to pay for future beach replenishments that are what they need basically to counteract the impacts of this jetty, to protect that community and keep it what it is today moving forward. I think it's really a matter of kind of when. It's not if, right, that they're going to be impacted again. It's not if they're going to be devastated by the next storm. It's when. And when do people decide to retreat? Is that maybe probably not in my lifetime, I would guess. But, you know, in the next hundreds of years, these coastal systems are going to be completely reorganized. And people are not going to be able to continue to live where they are now because sea level is going to continue to rapidly accelerate. Even if we stop emitting carbon emissions tomorrow, even if we stop all CO2 emissions, we would still see substantial sea level rise in the coming decades. And so that is going to fundamentally change how people live in these coastal environments, kind of regardless of the actions we take now. And so pieces of that are going to play out in my lifetime, the course of my career. but parts of that are going to be future generations, right? This is a problem we're going to continue to grapple with for centuries to come. And it's just a matter of how bad it's going to be, which is still an open question.
Absolutely. I feel like the term it takes a village has never sounded more accurate in my mind. It's like thinking about it's not just impacting the people who live or, you know, the ecosystems that are surviving right on the coast, but everyone inland too, because, you know, it's just going to keep happening. So there's no way to really stop it, but we can just support each other and try to work around it, work with it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing all of this with us and our listeners. Now is the question that I was talking about earlier, which is where can they learn more or connect with you and your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you Google my name, you will find me, but you can also go to my website, iceandclimate.org. You'll find more information about me there, and there's a link to contact me. But more than happy to connect. My email is just my first and last name at une.edu. So I'm, you know, widely available if anyone would like to connect. Would love to stay in touch.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show today, and I hope that you have a great rest of your week. That's all we've got. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having this conversation. Really appreciate you all highlighting some of our work, and looking forward to continuing to collaborate with you all in the future.
Thank you for joining us. To learn more about this story, head to our website to read the blog, which includes some images from this work, or check out the description to see the resources we discussed. Thanks for joining us on the GeoTalks Pod. If you enjoyed listening, subscribe to our podcast and turn on notifications so you don't miss any episodes.